So it's now a great pleasure to welcome to this place Mr. David Grant, who has come from Great Britain. He crossed the channels, no strike, so he's here. Yes. So just to remind everybody that David is your actual president for CESAM, which is European Simulations Society.
Hi, good afternoon. I was going to, I prepared this little paragraph to say in French to just show you how bad my French is. But even that went so badly that I thought I won't embarrass myself that much. I apologize for delivering this lecture or discussion in English, which ironically I will point out is also not my first language. So you'll have to bear with me. As Clément said, I live and work in Bristol in the United Kingdom. But as you might have seen from the little screensaver that came up before my slides came up, that's not where my heart is. So I'm originally from Cape Town in South Africa, and I've lived in exile for 25 years and continually working on a return to home package, which hopefully someday will materialize. Clément asked me to talk to you this afternoon about simulation, CRM, if you will, and simulation and the role within that. But I thought I'd start by just, first my disclosures. So I'm a funded researcher and I have a consulting firm that I try to attend to but not have much time to do. But I wanted to start by saying, making a statement that I hope in this audience probably everybody would agree with, which is that healthcare is a basic human right. And it's one of the things that I as a physician, and I didn't say my background is pediatric intensive care, that I really struggle with is that there are parts of the world where basic healthcare is often not as accessible as in the places where I work. The problem I have, though, is that there's a huge paradox within that, because if this is a basic human right, then it's also true to say that the very thing that's a basic human right is also more likely to kill me than anything else that I might access. And so many of you will be familiar with this report published by the Institute of Medicine now 18 years ago nearly, and I was interested by the comments of Kate about adoption and where we are in terms of responding to this. But basically, those of you familiar with the report will say that in the US, this report said that there were between 44 and 98,000 people a year who die because of preventable harm by just accessing medicine. There's been new reports since then, so this one published in 2011 actually states that in the US now is now more than 200 people a year who die just because they access healthcare. And in fact, when you look at the cause of death, it is just accessing it is the third most frequent cause of death, only second to cardiac disease and oncology or cancer, which is quite stark. Now, I don't want to, in the interest of my American colleagues, just single out America. This is true, I think, in all the healthcare institutions that we work in. And this report published in 2000 by Sir Liam Donaldson said that in the UK, they looked at not just mortality, but also morbidity. Between 60 and 225,000 patients come to harm because of preventable, or come to preventable harm because of healthcare interventions. Now, there's been many publications since that has refuted these figures, and some of these papers now state that it's closer to between 12 and 17,000 people a year that come to harm. But let me ask you this. If Air France said tomorrow, their slogan is, we only kill 12,000 people a year, would you fly with them? I'm not sure that I would. And I think so we need to get past that particular statistic. And I think the problem is that as we look at the evolution of safety science, it's really moved forward quite a lot. Onto sort of now, I guess what people describe is this concept of age of complexity. So complex systems that requires resilience, human sensory networks, and distributed cognition. The problem is, though, that most healthcare organizations with their approach to safety, and I'll make the link in a moment, you might think, why is he talking about safety? He's not getting to the human factors, but I'll take you there. The problem I see is that many of our organizations are still stuck here in the late 1800s, 1900s in their ways that they approach and manage safety within their organizations. The other thing that I just wanted to, I find that people often use the terms human factors and crisis resource management interchangeably. And I think that these terms potentially have overlap, but are certainly different things. My hesitance in the term crisis resource management is because it implies that these principles are only valid in a crisis, which we all know is not true. And so for me, if you look at the definitions that people have of crisis resource management, or they publish, it's the skills or the non-technical skills that an individual and a team requires to manage a crisis successfully. And I guess what I hope to show you is that, at least in my institution, sort of approach to trying to implement human factors, with regards to the individual and the team part, which is where the CRM or the non-technical skills elements sit, there's an entire element outside of that that we ask our staff to think about. And it's this that I wanted to explore with you. One of the things that strike me is as I talk to my colleagues from all over the world, is that many of them have crisis resource management or human factor programs within their organizations. But when you ask them about the impact of those organizations, the evidence for that is often lacking. Now, if you contrast that huge amount of energy and principle or activity that people are putting into the system with the aviation industry, and I heard that there's some colleagues from the aviation industry in the audience, it's a complete and utter opposite to each other. And so what we wanted to do in our organization is really look at how the aviation industry went about it and where are the elements that we are going wrong, because we were, and I would say this is still a journey for us, but we were certainly amongst those individuals who had a very active human factors training program within our organization, but quite often with very little impact to show from that. And I think fundamentally the problem is, and I hope because otherwise I would feel very negative about my own organization, but you might manage some of these management strategies that many of our healthcare managers have. So they often sort of measure outcomes, and the outcomes that they set are really sort of targets, if you like, that is at the very heart of it focused on the minutiae or the sort of micromanagement part of it rather than the whole of the entire process. They often imply sort of or put compliance into place by actually holding staff to account for these targets, which they can never achieve. And so the game becomes to try and achieve compliance and therefore just serve the master rather than actively looking at the system. It views diversity and different approaches as something that needs to be ironed out, and so it tries to sort of achieve predictability and control. And when you looked at Damien's slide of that emergency room, that's not what that particular management would aspire to, the chaos that ensues then. And often in healthcare, it can feel very chaotic. And so what it does, it sort of pitches competitions of departments against each other, and it once again fragments this sort of organizational approach to things. And what you end up with is a disillusioned and often demotivated healthcare workforce, because it feels like I can never do well, I can never achieve because of the targets that you set me. Is that something you recognize? No? Oh, thank goodness. And for me, fundamentally, that is the first part that we wanted to try and address. And so we wanted to change the culture within our organization that harnesses the passion and the curiosity. Most people go into healthcare not because they want to be millionaires or they want to sort of have the esteem or the so-called esteem, but really because they want to make a difference. And so we tried to harness the passion and the curiosity of the staff in the department. We wanted to make sure that we encourage them to innovate and adapt. But at the same time, we wanted to create an organization where this new learning that they have, they can translate to new behavior. And doing that through a process where the learning occurs in a planned fashion rather than by chance allows them to actually, in a fundamentally sort of dynamic way, change the way that they work. Changing their own sort of practices, changing their own environment that makes their work better, which makes patient safety something not that's enforced on them, but actually that they organically feel part of. And this in itself leads to a pride in their work, a different sense of achievement, increase in morale. So all of the things we talked about that the previous approaches failed. And so this really was for us the first step. I talked a little bit about this idea that learning should happen by design rather than by chance. And so this concept of a learning organization this, as described in the literature, as a place where people strive to sort of improve their sort of or meet their expectations and expand on that, and where people are encouraged to think expansively in how they might change and try and achieve the aspirations, if you like, which often, I guess, flies in the face of the first comment I made. And so our interpretation of that, if you like, in terms of when we thought, well, how do we achieve that, was through these five different strategies, this idea of moving the learning curve away from the patient, personal mastery, team deliberate practice, systems thinking, and breaking down the silos. Can I ask, am I talking too fast? Is the speed okay? Bon? Okay. I guess in thinking about that, this concept of personal mastery is really the sort of function of each and every one of us within the as an individual that works in the healthcare workforce. This idea that I'm on a journey to learn lifelong and I'm continually going to try and improve myself, and it's my personal responsibility to do that. We have this idea that once I become a consultant like I am, that my learning's finished, that others now need to learn from me, which of course we know is not true. As technology advances, I'm a novice every single day of my life. When I'm at work and at home, I'm the only man in the house, so I'm a novice every day. I do nothing right. So we just have to accept that we need to continue to learn. This is a rubric published by the Mayo Clinic, which just, for me, captures this idea that as we go through our sort of pathway of experience and learning, that our learning never stops. Just the nature of what we need to learn changes. And so we need to embrace that as a healthcare community. one of the things, and I just very briefly show you this, is that, so one of the things that really strikes me is often when people talk about human factors and team training, as it's called, or CRM training, if you wish, people say, oh yeah, we had a course in that once. And it's this fallacy that if I tell you something once, that fundamentally will change your practice, which of course is nonsense. We know that. As a simulation community, we talk about deliberate practice, this idea of practicing, getting feedback. And so really that first introduction is just creating a common knowledge. And so in particular, when we think about human factors and teamwork, what we do is we think about, and you can see in the third column along there, the very first thing that we do is we send our staff an e-learning module that they do. Most boring thing in the world, I know, because you're looking at a screen, but it introduces the language. Then we have a 4-hour interactive workshop where the team discusses these concepts and starts forming norms within that. And only then do we move on to sort of simulation exercises where they have them in the simulation center first, then the point of care, or in situ, if you may. And then sort of the process builds from there. So it's a real sort of thought about how we introduce this process rather than a one-off event. It's going to be an event. And what we find is that on the whole, it takes about 18 months to get a team or a department to a place where they now, this becomes part of their daily life of thinking about it and talking about it. And for me, the holy grail is where I know that we've actually succeeded with those teams are when you get to a point where you watch them perform clinically and they take the same time to learn from that clinical experience than they will from a simulation experience where they debrief. And I find that quite often what we do as healthcare professionals, we don't take the same time to learn from our clinical experiences, because we have to move on. There's time pressure. There's the next element that we have to move on. And so what you hear them do, even though they've not been taught debriefing structures that Damien and Kate alluded to earlier, they use the same language. Because really what, for me, when I'm talking about the advocacy inquiry technique or the debriefing, what I'm doing is I'm helping that team learn how to reflect and learn. And so the end goal for me is to leave that team to be able to debrief themselves using the same structure and methodology than I as a debriefer do. And so what you see after 18 months when they discuss those clinical events, they use the same language and the same thought processes of thinking through them that we tried to teach them in human factors. And for me, that changes behavior. Okay. So simulation in its purest form is really just an opportunity for the learner to take that knowledge that they've achieved and then restructure that in making the connections and the interdependencies within their mind to take that knowledge into a practical knowledge so that they deepen their learning. In addition to that element, what simulation does, I guess, and I know I'm preaching to the converted, more than any other methodology is place that learner at the edge of their learning curve, steepening it and helping them to achieve new learning that they add to the learning that they've just deepened. And so what happens over time as you do this repeatedly, because you can, you don't have to wait for the next patient to arrive, what you notice is that people achieve competence at a much earlier state than they would naturally if they were just exposed to clinical practice, and quite often achieve a higher level of competence than they would have if they didn't have simulation to help them along that journey. Now I have, fortunately it's becoming less and less, but many conversations with my clinical colleagues, often many of them with shiny hair like myself, because of course it's not gray, that what is this nonsense about playing with dolls? Surely what we need to do is just get back to the phase where we stop people from limiting their hours of clinical practice, because if they do more clinical practice, they'll learn more. And what I always say to these colleagues is, for me, it's not about that. It's about, remember what I said about moving this early part of the learning curve, the incompetent or unconsciously incompetent novice, which we all were at one point, the most scary person in the world when they don't know what they don't know. And so having that individual, moving them along that learning curve to a threshold of practice where it's safe for them and the patient to be exposed to clinical practice. And this really is where simulation has a role. And then not for the learning to stop there, but for that same learning to, or process to continue in clinical practice. And so for us, we try and sort of set the paradigm of simulation and patient-based learning, if you wish, to be a continuum rather than one replacing the other. Now, I talked about this idea about our program in terms of human factors and what the individual learns. And so I guess in terms of the non-technical skills, I'm not going to go into those in great detail, but particularly what we try to get our individuals to focus on is the concepts of leadership, followership, capacity or their own personal capacity, and decision making. And for this afternoon, I'm not going to bore you by going through the whole program and all the details of it, but I do want to highlight some key issues. And so these are the elements that we tend to address in the sort of the whole of our human factors and team training program. And so we have 8 categories within that, which is akin to many other programs. And so this idea of leadership, followership, situational assessment, situational awareness, communication, decision making, and problem solving. And so these are the concepts that we have within that 4-hour working workshop that we have our teams of individuals go through and learn together. One of the fallacies in life, but one of the things that I find absolutely incredible is that the concept of team leadership, we spend days on resuscitation courses, and we refer to team leadership. We have literature that tell us how to lead, but actually when you look at how the leadership is attained, it appears to me that people have to sort of just attain that in their own level. And so we don't apply the same concept of deliberate practice to that particular skill, which is often the one that makes the most difference. And so what we've done is we've developed this tool, which you can see there, Aspire, which is a cognitive aid, if you wish, in the same way that people use A, B, C, D, E, that most of the world knows about, to think about their team leadership. And so once a month, we have our medical students, all our healthcare professionals, our nursing staff, all take part in a simulation where for an hour and a half, all they do is resuscitate a patient. Very tiring. But for that hour and a half, what they're doing, one of those individuals get an opportunity to be the team leader and implement this structure that we've taught them to actually practice being. And so what they get debriefed on, or their technical skill that they're trying to acquire, or non-technical skill, is the team leadership. And so they get feedback on that and that's what they get debriefed on. And what's really interesting is, because I think before we took this approach, it was always, well, who should be the team leader? And it's always the most senior, not even clinician, but physician in the room that was nominated as the team leader, which quite often was the wrong person. Because as many of them now say to us, since we've changed the structure, it's fantastic to not be cognitively loaded with leading the team when I'm trying to understand what's going on with this patient. And allows me to think, because otherwise my working memory is about the slice of a sort of a millimeter, and I can't think within that space. And so in fact, we're using those more experienced staff for their memory, their knowledge, and allowing them to think while somebody else leads the team, cheerlead, if you wish, the team through this process. One of my dreams is still to find a day when, and it happens now, but not as regularly as I like, that the person who looks after the patient, which in most healthcare organizations would be the nurse at the bedside, is the person who's the team leader. Why not? They know the patient the most. They know the structure. They're able to take the team through this. And as you'll see, what it starts getting away from is this idea that the person who leads needs to know everything, but actually that they use the whole team. So this point here of encouraging input. It also takes the team through a process where they share their mental model at the very beginning of that management of that scenario, or what they perceive is wrong with a patient. Anyway, I said I wouldn't go on, but it's something I feel quite strongly about. So if you're interested, I'm happy to talk much more about it. My video's just... Are we not going to play the video at all? I'll try again. This little video I wanted to speak. So I've just gone on for about 5 minutes about team leadership. And one of the things that we wanted to get away with is that the focus solely lies on the team leadership. And this little video, you can find it on YouTube. If you put in Derek Sivers, S-I-V-E-R-S.
Ladies and gentlemen, at 10, we talk a lot about leadership and how to make a movement. So let's watch a movement happen, start to finish, in under 3 minutes and dissect some lessons from it. First, of course you know, a leader needs the guts to stand out and be ridiculed. But what he's doing is so easy to follow. So here's his first follower with a crucial role. He's going to show everyone else how to follow. Now notice that the leader embraces him as an equal. So now it's not about the leader anymore. It's about them, plural. Now there he is calling to his friends. Now if you notice that the first follower is actually an underestimated form of leadership in itself. It takes guts to stand out like that. The first follower is what transforms a lone nut into a leader. And here comes a second follower. Now it's not a lone nut, it's not two nuts. Three is a crowd, and the crowd is news. So a movement must be public. It's important to show not just the leader, but the followers, because you find that new followers emulate the followers, not the leader. Now here come two more people, and immediately after, three more people. Now we've got momentum. This is the tipping point. Now we've got a movement. So, notice that as more people join in, it's less risky. So those that were sitting on the fence before now have no reason not to. They won't stand out, they won't be ridiculed, but they will be part of the in crowd if they hurry. So, over the next minute, you'll see all of the those that prefer to stick with the crowd, because eventually they would be ridiculed for not joining in. And that's how you make a movement. But let's recap some lessons from this. So, first, if you are the type, like the shirtless dancing guy, that is standing alone, remember the importance of nurturing your first few followers as equals. So it's clearly about the movement, not you. Okay, but we might have missed the real lesson here. The biggest lesson, if you noticed, did you catch it? Is that leadership is over-glorified. That yes, it was the shirtless guy was first, and he'll get all the credit, but it was really the first follower that transformed the lone nut into a leader. So as we're told that we should all be leaders, that would be really ineffective. If you really care about starting a movement, have the courage to follow and show others how to follow. And when you find a lone nut doing something great, have the guts to be the first one to stand up and join in.
Okay. For those of you who were children, you know that that's how they think we all dance, right? Okay. So really what we're starting to introduce for our team is that the leadership within the team really doesn't just relate to the leadership, but actually the followership, and we encourage them to this positive or independent thinking. Remember what I said where safety practices or safety science is evolving to, this idea of a network or human sensory network with distributed cognition. So that's really where we're trying to drive at, so that it's not just the function of that leader, but actually all of us to actually be aware and think about this whole process as we go along. We also use Reason's bucket theory. Who's familiar with this? Has anybody seen this? I don't know if this is impolite, but that's merde. Yeah, so if the bucket gets too full, it runs over. Yes? So when you're performing a task, you have these buckets, which is the bucket of the self, me as the individual within the task, the context of the task, if you like, something about that task that changes the complexity of the difficulty of it, and then also, you know, where you perform it, whether it's an unusual task that you perform or something like that. And so particularly we focus on the self to help people understand what are their capacity, what are the things that impairs their capacity in terms of attention, working memory, which I've alluded to before, their limitations, whether it be physical or mental, their mental state that they find themselves in, and physiological state. It's amazing the amount of times you find a surgeon who has just had a stand-up row with somebody about something, I don't know quite what, you know, and I don't know specific examples, and then walk into that operating theater to go do the most complex of cardiac surgeries. And I would argue that they're not in an ideal state to prepare themselves for that that particular event. And so we try and focus on helping people preparing themselves to perform best. So once we've sort of gone through this personal mastery around human factors and teamwork, the next step for us is to really focus on systems mastery. And what I mean by this is, remember, so they've all done their workshops now, and now what we do is we sort of apply the same concept of deliberate practice to the team's functions. And so these teams go through a team deliberate practice event once a month. In the first instance, it might happen in the simulation center, but after that, certainly most of the time, we try and encourage them to do that at their place of work with the entire team that they work in. And what we're really trying to achieve is what I alluded to before, as they go through these tasks and they debrief, they start to develop this distributed cognition, an understanding of why the particular and I love the approach with the IPE debriefing that Damien and Kate talked about. But effectively, this is what we're doing. We're helping that team learn to understand why the other person performs the task in the way that they do. Is there something that I can do that can facilitate them doing their task better? Is there something that they can do that helps me to perform my task? So this distributed cognition model, a model of sort of a human sensory network, as we're going through this process, we're all monitoring and assessing what's happening. And what you find happens is that when a team learns in that fashion, suddenly this is a team who is able to sort of anticipate, monitor, react or respond, and learn from every event. And that's what gives your system the resilience. Not by confirming, forming, and making sure that we all perform something to exactly the same standard, but actually understanding what it is that we're doing, and that allows us to sort of adapt within the moment, and not just learn from crises, but every single event as we go through. And so this is what we model and build on in the simulation exercises. And as I said, after a period of about 18 months, what you find is that these same practices spill over to clinical practice, which in the end is the clinical or the goal of the whole exercise. Not to deliver a 4-hour workshop so I can tick a box to say that I've done it. And so during these debriefing of these events, and I'm not going to focus on them, we take the team through the other variables that we talked about, the task, the equipment, the environment they find themselves, something about the organization on that day during the scenario that impeded their performance. Or possibly help their performance, because of course it's our natural instinct, maybe that's just because I've been working in Britain too long, but to think of the negative before we think of the positive, right? I think it is a British habit. Anyway, let me ask you this. If I asked you to look at this picture on there, can anybody tell me whether they perceive a difference between the two ampules? Sorry, thank you, Damien. okay, so if I told you, or would you agree with me that in a moment of panic, rush, when your ED room looks like Damien's ED room, the photo that he showed you, that those two ampules and the boxes they're in might look the same? Oui? Oui, okay. So if we can agree that, so I can tell you that this we identified, by the way, that one there, I'll show you, that one's adrenaline. And you can see that somebody's already applied adrenaline sticker to that. Somebody tried to sort of address that already within the team, and the other one's morphine. And I can tell you that this came up during one of those monthly simulation exercises. We identified this. And actually, one of the team members identified that this was a latent threat within our environment. So it wasn't a clinical, but let me show you, I just wanted to share with you a hypothetical story of a clinical situation that may have occurred at a hospital called St. Elsewhere. So on a particular day, a patient is in the anesthetic room and is having its preoperative sort of sedation given, and for some reason that particular patient arrests. The physician shouts at the nursing assistant to get the drugs here now, we need to give this patient adrenaline. And so the poor nursing assistant grabs the wrong bottle and administers this patient several doses of morphine, and so the patient dies peacefully, but without adrenaline, okay? So how do we respond, and this is the old fashion, how does the healthcare sort of patient safety department respond? Well, the first thing it does, it looks for the bad apple on the good tree, because the tree's fine, right? There's nothing wrong with the institution. And so what it does this, and actually we use it as a verb, don't we? We do a root cause analysis. Do you have the same thing in front? What's the French version of root cause analysis? RMM. Okay. I don't know why I asked, because I knew I wouldn't be able to pronounce it properly. But anyway. Okay, so that we do a root cause analysis, and what we say is, hang on, that particular person didn't double check the drugs. So let's train that person. That'll fix the problem. Right? What we don't do is we don't tell other departments because it's embarrassing. We also don't think about the fact that these ampules are the same because, you know, sort of we're not going to evaluate the systems. And what happens is the system never gets redesigned. And so as a matter of fact, this very same thing may happen again. It's one of the things we best of in healthcare. We keep learning the same lessons without fixing them. And so we wanted to change that. And one of the inspirations for that came from, I'm very nervous talking about aviation with aviation people in the room, but you can correct me if I'm talking nonsense. This is flight BA-38. So this was one of the first flights from, not Shanghai, it was from China. It was from China to Heathrow. And this was in 2008, so about 2 years before Sully landed on the Hudson. So about 2 years before that. And this particular plane came into Heathrow, and as it came into land about 2 miles out from the airport at a height of about 720 feet, they had complete failure of both engines. And so it fell, and this is the figure that I get chills thinking about. That's why it came by ferry and not flight. It fell at 124 foot a second from 720 foot. Not a lot of time to get on the floor, right? But nonetheless, these pilots landed the plane successfully, just short of the runway, and 12 people were injured. Now, the interesting thing is when the investigators approached us, remember I showed you this mock-up of an investigation within healthcare? So here's how they approached it. So the first thing that they did is they looked at the human factors or human performance of the skills of the pilots, if you wish, and they found that they adhered to the checklist, they did everything that they were supposed to do. They looked at the human factors and or crew resource management within the team, and they performed well. There was no problems there. And so they came to the equipment. And so, interestingly, Gordon Brown was never popular. I guess no politicians. The only popular politician I've ever met in my life is Madiba, Nelson Mandela. The rest of them we don't like. But so Gordon Brown was at the time the Prime Minister of the UK. And interestingly, his car was on the M25 just as the plane was going over there. So what they thought is maybe it was the jammers of his cavalcade or whatever as they were driving past that caused the problem. They wondered if there was a bird strike, which is interesting because it's about, as I said, about 2 years before Sully happened. And none of those things proved true. And so they came up with this theory that it was the icicle, and this is the scary part. I apologize if you're flying after this meeting. It was the icicles within the fuel tank that as the plane accelerated to level out as they were landing, blocked the fuel lines. And so the fuel wasn't delivered to the aircraft. And it has, they describe this process of what sounds like capillary networks around the fuel pipes that melt the ice. Sounds like a good idea. And so what they said is that this blocked at the time, and you can imagine because at the time they investigated, the ice was melted and wasn't there. So what did they do? So they put it through a simulator and they proved that actually feasibly what they described was true. And so they agreed a solution, which interestingly, to me, if I was a pilot, I couldn't ever think that I would do this. So they say, as you're falling at 124 foot per second, don't throttle up, throttle down. Pull the plane into idle. Imagine that. And then because the plane's idling, the fuel flows slower, the icicles melt, and then when you throttle up, you'll land. But they showed in simulations that this actually worked, and so they agreed this implementation plan. Okay, that's impressive, but not so impressive. Here's the bit that really struck me when I read about this. They implemented organizational learning, and what I mean by that is they agreed this new approach to this dealing with this problem across the aviation industry. And so at every single level in organization, this was implemented with making some subtle changes to the this checklist, if you like. And they went, put their teams through deliberate practice and mastery learning to implement this successfully. And we all know to unlearn is far harder than to learn, right? And here's the proof of the pudding. 10 months later, a Delta flight from Shanghai to Atlanta in Montana over the Greater Falls, the same thing happened. But they landed the plane safely because the pilots implemented the new checklist. And what it got me thinking is, it takes me so long to change something in my same organization. If this happened in my hospital at the time, that plane would have crashed again and we would have gone, oh, it's so sad, we must learn from this. Right? And so for me, it was a real call. And I know many physicians and healthcare professionals hate being compared to the aviation industry. But it was a real wake-up call for me about how we need to deal with these things and learn from them and change the way that we behave. And so what struck me is that even though we had this expansive human factors and teamwork training program within our organization, the organization is like any other healthcare organization. You have the Department of Quality Improvement, the Department of Patient Safety, the Department of Clinical Governance, the service delivery, and then education. And they only meet infrequently. In fact, you sometimes find that one of these departments is doing something that you're doing, but you didn't know that they were doing this. And so it seemed ludicrous that we were changing our team or training our teams in this concept of human factors and teamwork, but we weren't doing the same rigorous or applying it as rigorously to our patient safety department. And so we developed this course called Human Factors of Error. And what we do with that is with our patient safety and our clinical governance leads within the hospital, we teach them the same curriculum as we teach the rest of our clinicians around human factors and teamwork so that they have those same principles. We teach them simulation educator skills in terms of debriefing. So what Damien and Kate talked about earlier, advocacy inquiry, we teach them to help understand the mental models of the individuals when this particular incident happened, so that we can understand what was happening for them. Work is done, not work is imagined. We taught them team leadership because quite often they come up with these very integrated plans when you read them on paper, but they never happen because they don't implement them properly. They don't change manage. They don't have the leadership skill to manage that change. We taught them to use simulation as an investigative tool when they come across these things so that it's not just from that perspective. And then also testing the feasibility of these plans. And it really starts all driving towards this concept of a learning organization that we were trying to achieve. Now, one of the elements in terms of with this human factors, in fact, when you, how many of you are human factor professionals? I.e., that's your, okay, now I'm in trouble. Two of you, okay. Please be gentle in the questions afterwards. But when you talk to human factors professionals, even my perceptions or concept or how we imply it is not pure to the science of what they do. And so when you look at human factors, a lot of it is about designing systems before you actually interact with them to optimize them. And so we try and use simulation in that same process. So whether it relates to this or the systems design is the next part of our strategy. So whether it's spaces or the process or the patient care pathways. And I'll just very briefly show you. So we recently in the Children's Hospital went through a redesign of our resuscitation department in the emergency or resuscitation bay within the emergency department. And so what we did is we ran this major trauma case, and you can see people are standing around talking about the spaces around them, really starting to help the architects and the designers understand where how we need to change the space to optimize and make it more efficient, the work that they're doing. Now, I can tell you that this process went on so much that if you ever wondered what the inside on a CT scan of Sim Jr.'s head looks like, that's it. I'm reliably told by my friends at Lairdell that that does not invalidate my warranty, but it did shock me a little bit when I saw these pictures of, they thought it was very funny. I thought they destroyed the mannequin. But CT scan, okay. MRI might have been different. But they took the patient through the whole process. In the same way, my organization provides ECLS or ECMO as a rescue cardiac service. We don't provide respiratory ECMO. And so I guess it's something that we in my institution do somewhere between 24 and 36 times a year. So you could argue something relatively infrequent for us or that we continually need to practice. And so they have a very active simulation program within this. And recently, they redesigned our CT scanner. Can anybody see what the problem is here? That's a mannequin, not a patient, by the way. What's the problem? Translation's gone? Okay, I'll try. La tête, wrong side. Yeah, you see that? So that his head is this side, and we couldn't get the head. So when they designed the space, we hadn't, our circuit couldn't come around the gantry to have it on this side. And so what happened is, on that particular day, and that's the lead perfusionist scratching his chin there, trying to think about what's happening, they decided that actually if they put a small section of extra length into the circuit, it will allow the pumps to get around this side of the patient to allow the head to go in. And I kid you not, this happened the very next day we put a patient on, so this is the same patient. The staff are all very happy because they practiced it yesterday. And actually this time we were able to get his head into the CT scanner because we could get the pump around. It's the kind of things that unless you use simulation to help you think through your systems and the way that you deliver care, you would never know unless you have a clinical patient on that bed space. And so we try and think about, in fact, I talked about these team deliberate practice exercise. So as it's a monthly exercise, every month we ask these teams to think about a particular system that they want to have as the main process that they take that particular simulation exercise through, so that they continually redesign the processes of care that they deliver. And then the last part is really the diagnostic part, which is what I'm alluded to. This concept of on a monthly basis, every team going through a process where we're evaluating some part of the care that we deliver to try and proactively improve it before a patient comes to harm. And I don't need the sound on this, that's okay. It's okay, I don't need the sound. In this particular exercise, this is a simulation. And so it's we have a beating heart simulator that attaches to a physiological simulator, which this patient is attached to, that they're taking through. And in this particular case, we asked them, what's the thing that scares you most? And they said, well, actually, if the oxygenator fails while the patient's on pump, that's a very, very scary thing. And I said, oh, that sounds very scary. How many times have you had to do that? And so in the entire department of more than 250 years of experience, guess how many of them has ever done that particular procedure? Okay. So what they did is they went through this exercise, and as they played through it, the very thing that became apparent is that this guy here, who's the perfusionist, and his perfusionist support person on behind him there, were the only two that actually knew where the oxygenator was being stored. And so when they needed to change it, they needed to explain to people where it was or leave the pump. And so what they did is they changed where they saved these oxygenators. They talked as a team about who would fetch it if it happened, which gave me a little bit of confidence that maybe if it happened next time, they might actually manage that patient successfully. So in summary, really, the key messages that I wanted to give you this afternoon is that in the first instance, we have to change the culture within which our organizations, because otherwise what happens is, it's this situation where the organization espouses, or its espoused theory is, we want you to think about safety all the time, but actually, the theory in use tells them that unless you do what I'm telling you to do, you're in trouble. Right? And so the healthcare professional sits in this space where everything management says is blah, 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 but actually they don't mean it because they don't walk the walk. So you have to change the culture that engages that very reason that people came into healthcare to help them sort of make their own working environments better. And so if you do that, plus you combine that with this concept of a learning organization where we create opportunities for them to learn by design rather than by chance, with a integrated curriculum of human factors that takes them through not just the process of acquiring the non-technical skills, but also having the opportunity through deliberate practice to actually practice implementing those skills, because it doesn't come naturally. These are not things that we're taught in medical school. We're trying to change that. So we teach this to our medical students now. And really, if you do that, I think only then will we become anywhere close in healthcare to deliver the kind of impact that they've been able to do in the aviation industry. Thank you very much for listening. Oh.
Y a-t-il des questions?
Are there any questions? Any questions?
Do you think that simulations fast tracks the learning curve or improve or bring learning curve on a higher level?
Yes, absolutely. I think the problem is, the example I always use, and I apologize, I'm a pediatrician, so of course I'm going to use pediatric examples. But if you're a pediatric resident and you come to the pediatric department in summer, or actually, let me change that. If you're a general practitioner, I know in America they call them family physicians, but if you're a general practitioner and you come to pediatrics in the summer, you might never see a patient with bronchiolitis. And so if you go to general practice, that's the thing that you will see most of the infants you see will have that in the winter time, but you've never seen one in a clinical context. How can you be expected to manage that patient? So I think what it does, it eliminates that element of chance. In other words, I have to be at the right place at the right time to manage that patient, to learn from it. It also, at least in most countries in the world, is unethical to make a patient worse before you start treating them. And so therefore, if you want to learn to manage all the complexities or levels of severity of a disease, to do that in the clinical workspace, particularly with work hours reducing, is quite difficult. And I think those are the experiences that we can translate into simulation, at least, to help people to learn those nuances and accelerate them, their learning curve in a way that clinical practice contributes to, but often fails to deliver for some learners.
So two new good reasons to use simulations.
Okay.
Bien. So thank you very much, David. À la demande de notre président Sofracim, je vous rappelle que pour ceux qui ne pourraient pas assister à l'Assemblée Générale en toute fin d'après-midi, vous avez des procurations qui sont disponibles à l'accueil, si vous vous souhaitez donner un bon pourvoi. Voilà, donc je vous invite à rejoindre la pause. Merci, à tout à l'heure.